Well, good evening and welcome to the third presentation in this, our 15th series of talks on faraway places with strange-sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the blue, Peggy Wright, with help from our webmaster, Hai Wong Wan, taking pictures at the back, and our research instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Melky. Our speaker tonight is a native of Port Huron, Michigan, on the shoreline of Lake Huron, where his family have lived for generations. Growing up, he wanted to be a photographer-explorer and was influenced by old copies of National Geographic lying about the house. After attending schools in Port Huron, he completed his BA and MA at Michigan State University in East Lansing and his PhD in geography at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, where his dissertation focused on resource processes and regional integration in western Nepal. His interest in the Himalayas stems from learning to rappel down the sides of grain silos on his grandfather's farm in Michigan, and from a year-long overland journey from London to Kathmandu in his late teens. Since then, his grant-funded research has taken him from the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee to Kathmandu in Nepal. He studied sustainable agriculture in Nepal, ecotourism in Samoa in the South Pacific, temple gardens in Bali, landscape change in Bhutan, and even Shangri-La in the geographical imagination in Yunnan and Tibet. His teaching career has taken him from Port Huron, Michigan to the University of Hawaii, and in 1987, he joined the Geography Department of Eastern Kentucky University in Richmond and is presently the Foundation Professor of Geography. He's taught courses like tourism development, global geopolitics, the regional geography of Asia, and cultural ecology. He's the author of 8 books, including the popular Errant Journeys, Adventure Travel in the Modern Age, published by the University of Texas Press in 1995, Himalaya, Life on the Edge of the World, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, and a Choice Outstanding book in 2000, The Illustrated Atlas of the Himalaya, published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2006 and the winner of the National Outdoor Book Award that year, and Himalaya Encounters with the Roof of the World, published in 2011 by the Center for American Places, University of Chicago Press. He traveled to Tibet in the summer of 2013 in support of his new book and film, and along with cinematographer Chris Radcliffe, they completed the ritual pilgrimage around Mount Kailash, crossing an 18,600-foot pass and spending nights in monasteries and pilgrim guest houses. Land of Pure Vision, The Sacred Geography of Tibet and the Himalaya, was published recently by the University Press of Kentucky. And his film, Sacred Geography, A Journey into the Heart of the Himalayas, is in post-production. Please give a warm welcome to David Zurich. David?
Thanks very much, Brian. And thanks, everyone, for coming out. I barely remember doing all of that stuff. I want to talk about this new book as a way of really discussing my work in the Himalaya, which began as a geographer. I'm still a geographer, but I'm finding now that photography is starting to usurp my geography. And I'll talk about that a little bit as we go along. Photography I've always been using as a sort of a visual language for my geographical studies. And I'm finding now that my geography is starting to inform my photography. So I've done a bit of a switch here. And this book, Land of Pure Vision, is a product of that switch. So let me begin with this picture, which is the last picture that I made for the book, and it's the last picture that shows up in the book. And there's a couple of things I want to say about this picture. One, it has a certain Three Musketeers quality that I like. But the two people that I'm with, Mark Larimore is a professor of religious philosophy at the New School, and Ashok Gurung is the director of the India-China Institute, and myself, we were with a couple of other folks on an expedition around Mount Kailash, summer of 2013, as a reconnaissance for a new proposed international peace park based on the sacred landscape of the Kailash region that would involve China, India, and Nepal in a cooperatively managed landscape park. So that project is an ongoing project. It'll take a couple of years to complete at least the initial reconnaissance. So we were there partly for academic and scholarly and even policy purposes. I was there to finish this project that I'd been engaged in for about 10 years in the Himalaya, photographing sacred places. The mountain behind us is Mount Kailash, which is the most sacred place in the world for peoples of Buddhist, Hindu, Jain, shaman faith, peoples from the Himalaya region. And we were all in one way or another on our own personal pilgrimages as well. So it was a very interesting expedition. This photograph here was one of the first photographs, maybe the first photograph that I took in this series. It was a series that I worked on over 10 years intermittently. And I want to talk a little bit about this picture. I wasn't sure what I was really doing when I took this picture in terms of any sort of conceptual project. I was just making photographs. And this image appealed to me as I was making it for purposes of geometry and spaciousness and light and so forth. But it's a picture that is ironic in a way, that the architecture is all wrong. It belongs in a Japanese tea garden. It was a peace pagoda, one of many peace pagodas or peace temples that were built around the world by a group of monks from Japan. And it sits above the Indus River, above the town of Leh in Ladakh in northwestern India. And it's overlooking some contested geography, a territory that is claimed in one case by Pakistan and India, and in another case by India and China, places of the Aksai Chin Range in northwestern Himalaya and the Kashmir region of India-Pakistan borderlands. So these are places where there's been a lot of geopolitical intrigue, a lot of military operations, warfare, essentially. So it's a fitting place for this particular peace pagoda. And when I was making this photograph, I was just exploring the idea of individual places that had a sacred or spiritual significance for local people. I wasn't really tying these places together in any way. A few years later, I was in the eastern part of the Himalaya range in Tibet, in an eastern part of Tibet called Kham. And this is a photograph from a lake, Yulhun Lhotso, which is a sacred lake and a pilgrimage place in eastern Tibet. You're looking at carved rocks, carved in scripture. They're called Mani stones. But we were coming down from a high pass, really where that glacier is that you see in the background, and we came down into this lake and we got caught in a storm. And it was just a serious blizzard. And then it cleared out, and we were here for a couple of days, and things melted pretty quick in the sun. And I just started noticing all these rocks that were just boulders when they were covered with kind of ice and snow, and then all of these scriptures started to just, as the snow was melting off them, they were just starting to appear. It was a really kind of a magical thing, and I started thinking a little bit more seriously about what I was doing photographically. In the end, this project connects my work as a geographer with my work as a photographer in a number of ways. I have been for many decades working in the Himalaya, mapping places, making maps, using maps, working with geographical imagery of all kinds. So the idea of working with images that represent the landscape was something that's kind of been fundamental with my own professional background for really about 35 years now, a little bit more than that. And, you know, it allows us to represent places in conventional ways, maps that we all use in one fashion or another, a map like this showing the region. But we can take information that we gather from satellite images, from remote sensing platforms, from various digital sources, and we can convey the landscape in other more creative ways as well. This is a digital elevation model, building up layer upon layer upon layer of data to create a different kind of perspective of the Himalaya range. And when we're doing this, we're essentially creating this pixelated world that allows us to understand a little bit better the kinds of issues and concerns that we might have. And as a geographer, many of these were empirical interests of mine for many years. But in this project, I was interested in a sense, mental maps, maps of the human consciousness, maps that we hold in our minds that help us navigate the world and make sense out of the world. And in the case of the Himalaya, many of these mental maps are very formal, and they're embedded in religious tradition, in liturgy, and in tangible places that express this kind of notion of a sacred world. So along these lines, you know, as a photographer, and those of you who do photography, particularly in cultures other than your own, or even with an individual, to imagine, you know, who's holding the camera and what kind of intention is a part of that process is a big part of photographic, critical photographic studies. And this is very much a concern of mine as a photographer, to try to imagine myself taking pictures of a place that I'm not from, among people that are not my people. What am I doing in this kind of a place, trying to understand it a little bit better using a certain kind of a technology? You know, digging into this over the years and looking at how this notion of sacred geography, sacred landscape, sacred space can get represented, one way it does is through paintings, traditional paintings that you would find in monasteries that would have a ritual purpose, such as tankas. This is actually a landscape painting made by a friend of mine in Kathmandu, whose background is in formal tanka painting, and he is carving a niche in the tourist trade in Kathmandu, creating really more pictorial works that he populates then with places, sacred places, coming out of Buddhist and Newari and Hindu traditions of Nepal. In these kind of representations on maps or on paintings, stylized ways of coming to an understanding of how we might organize the world. We all do this. And then to imagine how this becomes imprinted in the landscape physically then. So for example, in this case, in Damshun County in the Tibetan Autonomous Region, there's a ceremonial ground that sits beneath a sacred range of mountains that overlook another lake called Lake Namso. And this gate, on the one hand, is an architectural feature in a landscape. On the other hand, it's a signifier of moving from a secular to a spiritual space, but only at the time of a ceremony. Any other time, no. So here we have the notion of sacred geography tied to ritual practice, and it gets at the notion of places that become sacred because human faith sanctifies them. In effect, people make places holy by practicing their faith in a place. And in the Himalaya, this is very much the case, but there's something else that's going on as well. In thinking in these terms, thinking of a world, a landscape world that has places that are of a spiritual character, that are interconnected, and these are places that are known places, I'm used to working with grids and coordinates that are easily mapped. But the coordinates in this kind of sacred geography are ritual coordinates. But they also can have markers. They could be cairns, they could be prayer flags, they could be the confluence of rivers, places that are deemed auspicious for one reason or another. So that, in effect, these ritual coordinates start to define a sacred map that's shared by many, many people. And this is what I slowly began to work through over the course of this 10-year project, intermittently going back to this part of the world. So there are places then that become important. This is a set of lakes in Nepal, Gosekund lakes. They're places where shaman priests would gather in the summertime for a ceremony, a ritual ceremony. They're a place of pilgrimage, kind of a magnetic place for people. In a very stylized way, the center of the of this notion of sacred space is actually a mythological mountain, Mount Meru, which in its physical manifestation sometimes is equated with Mount Kailash, and Mount Kailash goes by a number of names, depending on what language and which group you're, of people you're working with. But in this case, this is a tanka, a traditional monastic painting, that represents the notion of Mount Meru as an axis mundi, a connector between heaven and earth. And this particular painting is in this particular monastery, which is in Bhutan, a monastery called the Trongsa Zong. And because it houses many important paintings, and it itself is an important monastery, it then has taken on significance as one of these coordinates in this larger sacred map of the Himalaya region. In effect, then, what I was doing was trying to photograph or make images of physical markers in the landscape that represent important places in the mental maps of people who practice one or more of the faiths of the Himalaya region. So in effect, I was looking at some sort of physicality, sometimes sort of tangible evidence of this. To organize this imagery and to organize my work, then, I was kind of developing ways to think about this a little bit deeper than just going around and taking pictures of holy places, and to imagine it in a little bit more fundamental way, and in many ways a more geographical way. So, on one hand, you know, nature is a powerful force everywhere, and it's certainly a very powerful force in the Himalaya and the Tibet Plateau. It kind of, the elements sometimes will strip your physical self, and it really creates a kind of a, in a way, a purity, a way of looking at things, because it just forces a focus that otherwise doesn't happen. But there's also a natural energetics in the Himalaya. And let me explain this. This is a photograph of the source of the Ganges, near the source of the Ganges River, up in the Bhagirathi Mountains, and I'll show a couple of other pictures of this a little bit later on. But in this particular photograph, this is the Ganges throughout India. It's one of the holy rivers of India. Water itself and the flow of water is equated with a sort of a divine force. And so we have here the origins of a very important place that flows throughout the entire northern Indian subcontinent. And above the source of the Ganges, which is a little bit above where that photograph was taken, it actually, the river is actually gushing out of the snout of a glacier. There's an ice cave, and then the river's coming out. And above the glacier is this mountain called Shivling, which for Hindus is a very important mountain, probably second to Mount Kailash. So Shivling, representing this kind of summit, this, in a sense, if we want to equate it in this way, with this male power, energy power, and the water, oftentimes equated with this female, in Eastern Oriental thinking, we would equate with this yin-yang idea, and the balance between these two. So Shivling and the source of the Ganges then are really, they go together and create a very powerful place. And there's a very old temple that's located up here called the Gangotri Temple that's devoted to this particular spot. So, you know, the mountain is a result of the upthrust of the earth, and the river is eroding the crust. So we have these very powerful forces. I mean, geographers refer to mountains as high-energy environments, and the Himalaya are a seismically active place. And the altitude range is enormous, and the power, the erosive power of rivers is magnificent. So we do have a very very strong physical environment in the Himalaya. And so, on the one hand, one might imagine a sensitivity to these earth energetics, and particular places are deemed auspicious or spiritually powerful, because they nestle into and are situated within these physical energy systems. you know, that's a part of it. And then to take that notion and to kind of anthropomorphize it in the form of deities like Kali, for example, overcoming Shiva, the deity of creation and destruction, takes this idea and extends it into the realm of spiritual faith and belief. And then these places can be marked in the landscape in certain ways, in this case through actual statuary and shrines. This is a photograph of a river valley of Bayul, a place in Tibetan mythology that's considered to be a treasure place, a place where scriptures or wisdom are recorded and kept, and in a way hidden for people to find. This is a long tradition in Tibet, but this is an important one of these kinds of places. And in this particular spot, the river is flowing through a beautiful gorge, and there are several monasteries that are clinging to the cliffs above this river. And it's a famous place in eastern Tibet because of the monastic tradition of the area and the actual landscape itself, the physical landscape. Another way to think about this, another way that I've been thinking about it during the course of the project, is to imagine then the idea of place, these places that emerge as a result of people living in a spot. We all have places that are important to us. I mean, geography, very much as a geographer, we study places. Maps and coordinates and latitude and longitude measurements can give us locations, but these are abstractions. It's when we experience life in a location that it really becomes a place for us. And for most of us, probably the place that's most important is the place where that contains most of our memories, because these are the places that shape us, because we are, in effect, the sum of our memories. So think of the idea of place in this way, and the term topophilia was introduced or used by a geographer, Yifu Tuan, to kind of get at a person's relationship to a place. It could be a relationship based upon love, kind of the love, the real, tangible, emotional love of being in a place for a long time, or the love that may be a reflection of a sense of divine love flowing through a place. It could be fear and the need to appease wrathful deities that may reside in a place. And these beliefs then make locations significant to us. So in my world and in your world, in our ordinary world, we are always confronted with this issue of place and how we live in a place and how we design places and how we take care of places and how we move from place to place. And we have a lot of technological gadgets that allow us to move very efficiently and very effectively from one place to another. And, you know, with my students, I kind of reflect on, this is probably the first generation that has become so advanced in their technological measurement of space and place. I mean, every iPhone is embedded with a GPS unit, and your WKU probably has a campus map that students navigate through with their iPhones, and it's quite amazing how strong this is. And this is an empirical mathematical reckoning of the world, and oftentimes it can be a distraction if it means that we're relying upon that kind of mathematical coordination as opposed to just bumping around and stumbling through space. You can learn a lot by stumbling through space, but we can move through it very, very efficiently. So we're accustomed to doing this for sure. But when we get into an abstraction that doesn't really tie into the notion of how things should be organized, or how we know them to be organized or are accustomed to being organized, it can be very disoriented. So this photograph, for example, is a photograph along the Yarlung-Tsangpo River. And on the one hand, it's a pretty picture, but it's actually a bend in the river that contains some very important monasteries. And in my own way, I was interested in the fact that these monasteries were actually invisible because of the mist this morning. So that's why I took this particular picture. But it's also kind of a disorienting picture, and it's got a sublime serenity to it, maybe. But it wouldn't necessarily conjure up any
particular place in most of our mind. Yet, for Tibetans, this is one of the most important places on the plateau. In some cases, within some of these places, not only are monasteries built and temples built and chapels built and people visit, but statuary are designed to not only mark space, but also to configure time. This is a statue of the Maitreya Buddha, the Buddha of the future. So in some cases, these places are actually situating space and time in relationship to one another, which adds an interesting aspect to them. Here, that photograph of the Maitreya Buddha was looking to the future. This picture right here is a picture of some chapels in Ladakh called Alshi. On the one hand, Ladakh is a very it's a high altitude, windy, glaring sun, dusty kind of place, and those kinds of places kind of just dry your skin and almost dry your eyeballs. I mean, it gets really intense. And you go inside one of these chapels, and they're some of the most beautiful in situ art in the world. The murals in the chapels of Alshi are just flat out gorgeous, and it's like going into someone's mind, a colorful womb or something when you go into these chapels. And it's such a stark contrast from the outside. And you know, there's a lot of explanations about the Alshi chapels, and there's beautiful books done on them and so forth, but physically when you're there, you can't help but feel that they were designed to create this little sanctuary in this very forbidding terrain that someone could move into and get totally lost in their own consciousness in this kind of a place. It's very, very strong feeling that way. Places that are places of pilgrimage, that are places where people visit for purposes of atonement, to gain spiritual merit, these are very, very common. This is Drakyupa, sort of caves, not too far from Lhasa. And they're easily, you can get to them very easy, you can drive right up to them. They're beautiful. It's kind of a limestone studded landscape with all these caves. I don't know if you can pick it up from the back, but the entrance to the caves have two things to them. They have pock marks from bullet holes, and they also have currency pinned to them. And during the Cultural Revolution, well, actually during the Chinese occupation of Tibet, some of the Tibetan resistance fighters, took refuge in these caves. And then also during the Cultural Revolution, China destroyed much of its religious architecture in Tibet and elsewhere. So these places were shelled and bombed and, you know, sprayed with bullet holes. But that hasn't eliminated their significance spiritually, and they're still probably one of the most highly visited pilgrimage spots in Tibet. In the sense of what I'm simply calling a kind of a sacred geography, and let me just say that in my mind, this sacred geography is kind of this world that we inhabit between measured earth and our own consciousness. It's a world that we create in our mind, and we can do this individually, and we all may have that sense or not, but we can also collectively share in some sense of this. But it does require these places to become connected, you know, these individual coordinates to become connected into a grid, and this happens in a lot of ways. So I was kind of thinking of images that captured this notion of networks and connection and connectivity and so forth. So one of the important ways is through pilgrimage, through physically people traveling from place to place. And it's a very purposeful travel. It's not kind of a willy-nilly roaming around. People are going to specific places for very particular reasons. So in India, we have entire traditions of sadhus travel from temple to temple or temple town to temple town. And in Tibet, we'll find people who may be traversing the entire plateau of Tibet in body prostrations. It take them over a year to go from eastern Tibet to Lhasa, genuflecting the entire way. And you'll see these folks moving along, and oftentimes you might have a family member or someone traveling with them pulling a cart, you know, filled with their clothes and cooking gear and a tent and stuff like that. So it can become a very intensive activity. It doesn't have to be that way. I mean, there's a lot of pilgrims who travel in luxury buses, you know, and fly. So there's different ways to do it, but in effect, then we've got movements that specifically are connecting places. Now, for you and I, our connection of places can be all of that, but it's also very much a technology connection. I mean, we are a hyper, super connected society. So we have available to us in ways that were unimaginable just a couple of generations ago, a means of connecting places so that we know about places in real time. And it's a tremendous, tremendous sources of information that we gain. And to the extent that this is geographical, we can display this and come up with maps. We can navigate our way across the Western Kentucky University campus or find our way to Florida with GPS systems and displays on our automobiles. And this is commonplace for us now. So many of us don't even really think twice about doing this. But there are other ways to navigate the world, I guess I would say. This is also a road. It's a funereal road, actually. It's the road that marks the passage of one from life to death, through Bardo and through this transformation, this transition that we all go through. So in this case, this photograph was getting at also a connection, but really a connection in time here, between present and future time, between life and after death and so forth. And this is also a very important place in this scheme of a sacred geography. Now, on the one hand, these places are determined over a long period of time based upon different criteria. But in Tibet, one of the determinations of where temples are located, where spiritually powerful places are, has to do with the idea that the entire landscape of Tibet is a landscape personification of a tantric deity. And Tibetan tantric Buddhism is geared towards designing a life that overcomes evil, essentially, and negativity. And to the extent that a demoness reclining, creating the Tibetan landscape, suggests a divine power that's emanating throughout this entire landscape. And so in this reckoning, and this is a representation of that, an old representation of that, then monasteries and temples are put in places because they will be helpful for humans to subdue this negative energy. And so these were all put here according to geomantic principles. One of the early kings of Tibet had married a woman from China who introduced to Tibet ideas of geomancy, and this became the basis then for determining the locations of many of the temples in Tibet. There are other kinds of markers that are less esoteric than that, that are much more physical. We saw a picture earlier of these Mani stones in this lake, and this is another example of it, where we find here a big boulder, large rock on top of a hill. The hill is the entrance to the Dzogchen Valley, which is a very important monastery and a center of teaching. And it's almost like a billboard. Yeah, I could imagine, you know, it is visible from a long ways away. I can almost imagine it playing that role as kind of a signpost that you've arrived or that, you know, you've made it. Prayer flags commonly found throughout the Himalaya, put in place for various reasons, but one of the reasons they're in place is to mark passageways and mark routes, and that could be a pass over a mountain, it could be the convergence of trails, the confluence of rivers, things that plug into this notion of a sacred space and a sacred geography. And then even song. And these are minstrels, wandering musicians who travel from village to village singing spiritual songs. So they are transmitters of an oral history that helps people understand that they are part of a larger community of faith, essentially. And so this kind of sharing happens as well. Song, it could be liturgy, teachings, the practice of lamas from monasteries traveling is commonplace throughout the Himalaya. I mean, now we find lamas traveling to Bowling Green and Nash. I mean, really all over the world. You know, in a sense. So now we're part of the global structure of the Himalayan sacred geography, essentially, through that transmission process. So that's happening, and it's been happening all along here in this part of the world. It's very much part of the traditions. So in a way, then, if we think about networks as being created from people moving, from signposts along the way, all these types of things, these are the connectors then that help to kind of knit these places together into some kind of comprehensible whole. You know, this is a celebratory thing. So oftentimes there's all kinds of ceremony and ritual and that are associated with these kinds of places at certain kinds of events. This is the Wanla monastery. It's just at the gateway into the Zanskar range, a range of mountains in the western Himalaya. But this was also a key time in the religious calendar of the Wanla region. And then the last little kind of section has to do with the notion of change, the idea that, you know, systems of belief do undergo change, but they are also maintained over many, many generations, despite external or even superficial aspects that change readily. And the landscape of the Himalayan Tibet is changing very, very rapidly. I mean, much of my work as a geographer has been capturing this in one way or another, and just by coincidence, the time of my life and my experience in the Himalayan over the last 40 years has kind of been synchronous with, I would say, some pretty fundamental changes in the region. If you kind of think of that part of the world in the 1960s, even early 1970s, it was not that much different than what it would have been in the 50s and 40s and 30s and 20s going back. But progressively, the pace of change is accelerating now, and so it's quite remarkable. And so we find this change in all kinds of things, including this whole notion of a sacred geography. So to look at change, then, is part of what I was doing, and this could be in an egregious form, the kind of change that was introduced by the destruction of religious monuments in Tibet as a result of the Chinese occupation of Tibet and the Cultural Revolution within China, where you had the scriptures burned and essentially an attempt to eradicate this cultural memory, which was very much a part of what was going on in Tibet. A lot of times it happens just incrementally. Buildings rot and fall apart, and they may be rebuilt, they may not. If they get rebuilt, they may take a whole different form. It even can go into a kind of an interesting realm. This is, again, the source of the Ganges, but we're closer now to where the river's coming out of the glacier. The ice wall, that's a wall of ice in the background, black and white. It may look like other things, but it's ice. And so that darkened spot is an ice cave. That's how the river's gushing out of there. Whenever I look at this picture, I have to kind of laugh or just smile to myself because it's a black and white picture, but I can tell you the day was just gorgeously colorful. The sky was so blue. You know, this silt-laden stream is picking up all of these greens, and the ice is this kind of bluish green. And I went inside this cave, and there was a boulder and an ice-covered boulder, and this sadhu with kind of tobacco-colored dreadlocks is sitting on it. It was quite a remarkable sight. But this river gushing out from this glacier is an interesting thing because the Gangotri Glacier is one of the fastest receding glaciers in the Himalaya and all across the Himalaya. changing temperatures are changing the size and the of glaciers, the amount of volume of ice in the glaciers. It's a matter of concern for many different people. In this particular case, you're looking at a map showing the recession of the Gangotri Glacier. A few years back, I walked up to the current source, the mouth, the snout of that glacier, with the high priest of the Gangotri Temple, which was built at the source of the Ganges, and the glacier has now receded back enough that it's now a couple of days' walk to actually get to the source of the Ganges. And this guy, I've known for quite a number of years. He's a photographer, as well as the high priest of this temple. And we were walking up, and we were exchanging stories. He was telling me about the breath of Shiva as being the mountain winds, and I was explaining adiabatic lapse rates and the physical geography about mountains, and then all of these boulders are being marked with these dates that geologists had put up there. So we were asking, he was asking about this, what was going on. I was kind of just explaining a little bit about climate change and what's going on with the glaciers up in the mountain, and I just asked him, I just asked him, what would happen if the Gangotri Glacier melted away and the source of the Ganges disappeared? And he just shrugged his shoulders and, this is the age of Kali, what do you expect? So we went on, and it didn't pose a particular existential dilemma for him, but it was an interesting conversation between a scientist and a priest going up this valley. Some of the change happens because of things that happen around these places. Here, this is a temple in Kathmandu that's almost completely obscured now by offices and apartment complexes, so to the point where if you're on the streets in Kathmandu, you wouldn't even notice this particular temple. So it's kind of disappeared from view. It isn't that it has disappeared, but when places do disappear from view, and these places are part of our mental map of the world, and we don't come into contact with them regularly, they can start to disappear from our mental map, and therefore they do in fact lose significance in that kind of a way. This is a very famous Buddhist site in Kathmandu Valley, Bodhanath. This is a large stupa. And, it's surrounded now by commercial buildings and rooftop restaurants and cafes and alfresco dining and so forth. And this is a photograph a friend of mine took from early 1960s. And at that time, this stupa was a prominent site in the valley. I mean, you could really see it. It was a marker from throughout the area, but now it's pretty much clothed in kind of an urban sprawl of Kathmandu. In some ways, then, what we're dealing with is this intergenerational transmission of meaning. What makes sense in one generation, can that sense be passed along? And will it make sense for another generation? This is two sets of guys, one in the Wara Monastery in Tibet and one at the Katasimbu Stupa in Kathmandu. They're about the same age. The group on the left are monks, and the group on the right are just kids in Kathmandu. But about three or four mornings a week, they come to this Katasimbu Stupa, and they circumambulate the stupa. They do a little prayerful ritual, and they get on their motorbikes and they head off to work. So this place is still important for them. They're still practicing their faith in this place. Even apparently, when you look at the two groups, and even if you're in those two places, it would seem like it wouldn't. It doesn't quite make sense, but it does make sense. So, during the entire course of this project, what I really was working with was the geographical imagination. The ideas that we hold in our minds about the world, the way the world is organized, where we fit into the world. And we all do this. You don't have to go halfway around the world to do this. I just happened to like spending time in that part of the world, and photographically I was enjoying myself. And it did provide me, frankly, with a great excuse to visit and deeply dive into some extraordinary places on the planet. So from a very personal point of view, as an artist and as a photographer, art has the ability to take us into these kinds of transcendent places or experiences. As a geographer and as an empirical scientist, we're taught to kind of be distanced from that, to, you know, to separate ourselves from it. And I find myself less and less interested in separating myself from it, which makes me less and less a scientist. This is what's going on. This is what's going on, by the way. So the photography then displaces my other kind of empirical methods, because what I'm interested in thinking about are things that don't necessarily lend themselves to an empirical approach. And I find the photography approach works those types of things. Let me just leave you with one last thing. This can really go quite far. James Hilton wrote a book called Lost Horizon. He introduced in 1931 or 32. He introduced the term Shangri-La, and we have collectively come to think about Shangri-La as some kind of paradise. And he was using it to refer to a place in Tibet where these, I think British or Westerners anyway, had crashed a plane and discovered a community of people. So, in this book, which was then made into a movie, we have an idea of Shangri-La, and in 2000 or 2001, the Chinese government determined that Shangri-La physically existed in Yunnan province, near a place called Zhongdian and Zhongdian County. And for the last 13 or 14 years, they've been developing it for tourism based upon the idea of Shangri-La. And this mountain is a mountain called Karpa or Kawagebo. There's two names for it. It's one of the holy mountains for Tibetans. And this is the kind of the literate, in James Hilton's book, he had a mountain called Karakul, which overlooked Shangri-La. So the Chinese kind of have co-opted that notion, so that this mountain, which is a real mountain, it's a spiritual sacred mountain, has become kind of the centerpiece for the Chinese commercial, developing commercial region of Shangri-La. So here we have an example of a geographical imagination that goes back, in the case of Tibetans, millennia, in terms of the sacredness of this mountain, being used in a way, the notions of Shambhala and the notions of sacred place being used in a way by James Hilton in his book to create a literary fictive world, and then that world becoming real again through the commercial developments of the Chinese and economic planners. It's very interesting when you start, it gets very circuitous, but when you follow it, there's a certain kind of logic to it. So let me leave you with that as something to think about, and I want to thank you very much for your attention, and I think, Brian, we do have some time for a few questions, correct? Okay.
Yes, back here.
Yeah. So I read somewhere that on top of Mount Kailash, the Hindu deity Shiva sits, and the Ganges River is supposed to come down from heaven into his bedrocks and then down into northern India.
Correct.
But now, as you pointed out, we now know that that's not where the Ganges River is. So my question is, so there's a problem for believers who have, you know, the scriptures to say one thing and then what we actually know from another thing.
Right.
So I can imagine it would reconcile it by saying, you know, it used to come from Kailash, but doesn't anymore, or that there's a spiritual river and not a physical river. But I don't know. So I was wondering, do you know how they reconcile what the holy book says?
I have no idea. But what you were just describing is actually true, and Mount Kailash as being the physical throne of Shiva, and Shiva is represented with dreadlocks, and so these dreadlocks actually are the braids of the rivers of the Himalaya, not just the Ganges, the Bhagirathi, and other rivers that are coming down. But the relationship between that and specifically the Ganges as a physical phenomena, how people reconcile that, I mean, this is a reconciliation that we all make between our beliefs and the real world and religions of all types and what we physically see around us. So we figure out ways to do it so we don't go crazy.
Yeah, back here.
Yes, I noticed the one of the first computer-generated maps.
Yeah.
Of the region that you showed, the almost fractal pattern to it. I had one. wondered if that doesn't show kind of a correlation between sacred geology and sacred geometry.
I didn't get into this too much, but basically I was just zooming. This was a digital map where you just zoom and zoom and zoom in until you actually get to the pixels themselves, which are basically little energy bytes. So, yeah, it would be analogous then to imagining this divine energy system where you could actually intersect with specific pieces of it. I just left it there, but you picked up on it, so I'll say something about it.
Was it the geographical landscape that first attracted you to the Himalayas, or were you already familiar with the culture, and that was part of it, too?
It was a combination of things. I was a little bit interested in climbing, but I grew up in Michigan, and it's flat. So Brian mentioned that we would rappel off my grandfather's farm because it was the only vertical wall we'd find. So I was interested in that. I'm not a John here. If you want to talk about climbing, talk to John. But I do like to climb. Do you know guys know John? I'm gonna shout him out because he fell in a deep crack in the ice and got out. And that's bound to attract attention to somebody. But I do climb somewhat. So I was interested in the adventure of the Himalaya, whether that was climbing or just being there, hiking around, or being part of it. And then over time, I was trying to figure out how to make a career out of this so I could keep on going back.
Yeah.
That's what it really was. So I became a geographer.
Yeah. Good.
You got me.
Yes, over here.
Why did you choose black and white for all of your pictures?
This project, I won't go into it in a big way, but I was photographing a large format camera, so it's a view camera with large format film. Tripod, the thing that goes over your head, you know, boxes of film. Partly I was working with black and white because I was interested in stripping away the distractions of color. Because color can be so beautiful that it can actually be distracting. So I wanted to get down into almost this, I was interested in, if you can imagine, this kind of infrastructure. In this case, a spiritual infrastructure. So that was part why I went black and white. Partly with black and white, I could control my materials. I could process the film and make the prints and that type of thing, and I don't do that in color. But I'm not wedded to black and white. In fact, I'm shifting out of black and white into color and out of film into digital. It's just that for this particular project, black and white was just the material that I was choosing to work with. But mainly, I think, to strip that color and distract it.
Yep.
It's really easy to get into mental maps. As one exercise, I grew up in northwestern Connecticut, which is kind of a hilly rural area. And one day I sat down and I thought about exactly what my family and the people in town, the way that they phrase directionality to places. Nearby places, and I suddenly realized that we were using all sorts of different words to describe the relationship. So, for example, we would say we're going into Hartford, which was about 20 miles away to east, or we would go down to New Haven, which was at a lower elevation, and also south, or up to Springfield, which is slightly north, and then the local. More local areas tended to be things like the next town over, which from where we lived was over a hill and into the next valley about 10 miles away. It would be over to Tarrington.
Right.
Another small town in another direction, which was taking a road which was largely going slightly uphill all the time, was always up to Winsted or down to Waterbury, down the Naugatuck River Valley. And the complex of variables that are actually involved with that are rather complicated.
Oh, it's amazing. It's why you can tell somebody a set of directions and they get lost because their mental map doesn't have the references that you have in your map and you think they're just dense and they're not. But in the Himalaya, people rarely, you never hear north, south, east, or west. It's just up or down. There's two words, up, Pella down, and that's it.
If you registered in Illinois, everybody would say out east.
Yeah.
Which if you live in Connecticut.
But it is interesting. Both space and time we measure this way. In Nepal, for example, if you ask somebody where something, have you got, it's always, you're already there, you've arrived, I pull you. You know, it doesn't matter if you still have 3 more hours to walk, it's like you've already arrived. You know? If you can get there that day, you've arrived. You know, so it's kind of interesting how, certainly how we do this, and culturally how this transfers across. Yes?
And the picture of the ruins of that temple, was that the one that's outside Lhasa or somewhere?
No, that's in the Yumaling Valley. Oh, it's quite a ways.
I've been to that one, it's called Yerpa, that's outside Lhasa. It was also destroyed in the Cultural Revolution, which is between 1966 and 1970. And then in 1991, they rebuilt it, built a new one, the new one.
There's been a lot of renovations of important temples, partly for their touristic value, frankly, in Tibet.
So how accessible is Tibet to tourists? How do you get there?
It's physically accessible. It's just layers of bureaucracy and paperwork, you know, and it depends on whether the Chinese perceive some unrest happening in Tibet that they don't want people to know about. I mean, one of the main things is just to keep word from getting out, you know. So if something's going on in Tibet, they tend to close the borders. Because everybody's got iPhones, and you know you can, you know, it's Facebook immediately, and then it's all over.
If you want to go, use the Sinoway. They don't pay me, of course, but that's the one I use, Sinoway. Because some of the agencies, travel agencies, can't get you the permit. They are bigger, and they can get you the permit. But plan well. You know where to go, and tell them, and then they'll put it on the paper, very very simple paper, and then you go with that one. And you have to be with a tour group. Even though you two can be a group. Just two people can be a group.
So could you travel alone?
And then they can have an agency and going along with you.
Twice I was able to and once I wasn't able to. And it really depends. It kind of year by year they change the terms of how you...
Depending on what's going on.
Yeah, depending on what's going on. And that's why a travel agent would know what the current rules are.
And you go from Beijing, you take a train. Better to go to by taking a train so that you can slowly get used to the altitude.
Yeah.
And then you fly back. Fly in.
You're doing a new film. So can you talk a bit about the film?
The film I'm working on is a cinematographic portrayal of this, but it really follows our journey from Kathmandu to Kailash and the circumambulation of Kailash, and then it works through interviews with sadhus, temple priests, monks and monasteries, getting their take on this whole idea of sacred geography. And so it's a short thing, about 20. We're shooting for 25 minutes. It's kind of in post production right now. Your footage is great. Hopefully it'll turn out
great. A place where you might be trying to have it available?
Well, I don't know. We're going to kind of look at film festivals and things.
Yeah. Wish you success.
Time for one more question?
If not, thank you very much for...
My pleasure. Thank you.
As this customer, we'll be giving a copy of David's book away, and I'm sure you'll be happy to sign it.